Should Western sanctions on entities in Zimbabwe be lifted? A UN special envoy says measures imposed by the US, EU, and UK are destroying people's lives. But are sanctions to blame for Zimbabwe's economic troubles? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. Sanctions were placed on individuals and entities in Zimbabwe in 2003. The US, EU, and UK imposed those sanctions, accusing politicians and entities of human rights abuses and repressing democracy. But Zimbabwe says the sanctions have led to widespread misery. The UN Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures agrees. Zimbabwe's government invited Alena Duhan to visit for 10 days. After speaking with ministers, civil society organizations, and businesses, Duhan called for the sanctions to end. She says they've had an insidious ripple effect on the economy and worsened people's access to health, food, education, and employment. Here's what Zimbabwe's justice minister had to say at the start of Duhan's visit.
We want the sanctions removed because they've affected every facet of our life. So in a nutshell, our document that we are going to give them will clearly indicate the effects of sanctions on our society.
The sanctions were imposed during former President Robert Mugabe's rule and were extended in February last year. The U.S. and EU cited a lack of progress on political and human rights reforms. At least 59 companies and more than 140 people, including President Emmerson Mnangagwa, have been sanctioned for alleged rights abuses. The UK recently imposed punishments on four Zimbabwean security officials over crackdowns on protesters in 2018 and 2019. The Western measures include travel restrictions, embargo on sales of military equipment, and a freeze on assets. The government says the financial measures are crippling the country's development, but critics blame government mismanagement and corruption. All right, let's bring in our guests from Harare, Obert Gutu, founder of the Nagona Legal Consultancy and Public Governance Institute and former Zimbabwean Deputy Minister of Justice and Legal Affairs. From Johannesburg, Piers Pigou, International Crisis Group Senior Consultant for Southern Africa. And also from Harare, Ibu Mandaza, Director of the Southern Africa Political Economy Series Trust. Thanks to you all for joining us today. We appreciate your time here on Inside Story. Obert, let me start with you. In the past, you've apologized for being part of opposition party politicians in Zimbabwe who repeatedly called on the West to impose and maintain sanctions on Zimbabwe. Why did you apologize?
Yes, I had to apologize because I felt after deep introspection and deep self-reflection and thought analysis, that I'd actually been, with respect, very naive to run along with the sanctions on Zimbabwe narrative. In fact, I think I was one of the most vocal, politicians then who were passionately advocating, for sanctions to be imposed. In fact, I actually thought then that the sanctions were actually too little, and I was advocating for even more, sanctions, stronger or bigger sanctions. And on further reflection, I then realized that, I think maybe my conceptualization of restrictive or restricted or so-called targeted sanctions was not exactly what then happened. I think I had this perhaps naive, perhaps too idealistic conceptualization of this animal called targeted sanctions. Because in reality, there's nothing like targeted sanctions. The sanctions against Zimbabwe have actually been wholesome sanctions. If anyone who has been targeted, it is the poor man and the poor woman in the townships, the poor man and the poor woman in the villages out there in the peri-urban areas. In other words, it is millions of the poverty-stricken and toiling masses of Zimbabwe who were actually targeted by these instructions. So with time, I then realized that I'd made arguably, I think, the worst mistake of my political career, associating myself and even openly advocating and passionately doing so for the imposition of sanctions on my beloved country, Zimbabwe. So up to now, I feel this deep sense of guilt, this deep sense of shame, this deep sense of regret. This is why I decided to go public and to say to my countrymen, to my countrywomen, to my Zimbabwean compatriots, that I'm sorry. And let me repeat, let me take this opportunity once again on Al Jazeera to reiterate my apology and to say that apology is total, is from the depth of my heart, and it's unconditional.
Igbo, have you been surprised by what you've heard so far from Special Envoy Doohan? Is this what you had expected to hear from her?
Well, I was quite surprised myself, because I think the first impression that more people had, many people at least, they thought this was an invitee of the government, that she would simply say what exactly the government wants to hear. And indeed, the itinerary set up for her appeared to be very state-centered and appeared to have left out the opposition and civil society. But I was surprised, yes, if the statement which was issued yesterday is correct, I was surprised that it's quite a balanced statement in that on the one hand, yes, she acknowledges the issue of sanctions, that even though they were targeted, they have had a debilitating effect on the economy in terms of perceptions and so on and so forth. But then she went on, which is why I was surprised, she went on to highlight that which most of us have been highlighting, the need for political and economic reforms, the need for a restoration by implication, restoration of constitutionalism, and the rule of law. And I think that resonates well with some of us who have been calling for a transitional authority in the country. On the basis that both the ruling party, the state, is beyond redemption. They have no capacity to reform. And the opposition has been battered enough, decimated. And therefore, there's a need to get together and have a transition authority, which gives the country a breathing space before the next election. Yes.
Piers, how much of an impact will this statement from the special rapporteur have, and how much weight does it carry?
Well, thanks for the question, and thanks for the opportunity to have a further discussion on this issue. I don't think the statement will necessarily have that much impact, although it does depend on the extent to which the key parties, those doing the sanctioning and those being sanctioned, use this in a constructive way. I do think there is an opportunity from this statement to pursue a more constructive dialogue about the issues that are on the table. I do think Mr. Han has raised some extremely important issues which sanctioning nations need to look at much more seriously in a generic way as well, not just with respect to these particular measures. The issue of overcompliance that she emphasizes in statement is an important one. But I do think that there will be some questions asked about the extent to which her analysis is kind of a cherry-picking one with respect to the major causal factors of the current lack of enjoyment that ordinary Zimbabweans have with respect to human rights, institutional integrity, and so forth. And while certainly the inference on the call for reform and dialogue and so forth points at those issues, there will be some that will question and will wait to see what evidence she puts on the table to support the kind of superlatives that she's added around the impact of measures that have been put in place. I mean, I would, for one, fundamentally disagree with Obed Gutu's reflections that these measures have had such a devastating impact on the ordinary individuals. They certainly have had an impact. I think there's no doubt about that. The question is, how do we weight that impact? And one would hope that the process that we've seen would enable a more constructive dialogue that looks forward with a view to seeing how these measures can be led and relating those to dialogue and reform issues that Mr. Hans put on the table.
Obert, of course, Piers just now disagreed with your viewpoint on all of this when it comes to sanctions, the effects that they've had. I want to give you a chance to reply.
Yes. When you look at the effects of the illegal sanctions on Zimbabwe, the effect has actually been, I mean, for some of us who lived in Zimbabwe literally for all our lives, born and bred here. So we know Zimbabwe, we know some of these places perhaps where Mr. Pig has never been to. I mean, out there in the villages, out there in the townships where you visit the poorest of the poor. So you get an opportunity, like for some of us, to see for yourself, you know, to actually appreciate from a personal one-on-one position, to see that, look, this is what sanctions have done. The decimation of what was arguably maybe one of Southern Africa's most sophisticated industrial base at independence in 1980. Now it's just a total shame. Okay, we have heard people talk of corruption, but you should also look at the symbiotic relationship between sanctions and corruption. Actually, I believe that actually, you know, sanctions are one of the main drivers of corruption in Zimbabwe. And we are saying, at the end of the day, when you look at the timing of the sanctions, it had really nothing to do with so-called non-observance of human rights and the rule of law. It had everything to do with the Revolutionary Land Reform Program, which began in earnest around February 2000. So Zimbabwe is actually being punished for embarking on something that was unheard of. I'm sure the former colonial powers and all the major Western powers were totally taken aback to say, oh, this little country in Southern Africa, how dare they do that? Taking land from about 4,500 or 5,000 white commercial farmers, that was just unthinkable. And then, like Chester Kroc and other guys in the United States said, let us make the economy scream. And boy, the economy did scream.
Ibo, Special Envoy Duhan says the unilateral sanctions and the overcompliance with the measures in their complexity had exacerbated pre-existing economic conditions, especially for those living in poverty, women, children, and the elderly, among others. Do you agree with that assessment?
It would be very difficult to quantify that, to qualify that, the extent to which sanctions or targeted measures would have had that effect. I think and one does want to be drawn into the debate, such as Obert Kutu has tried to provoke, of a polarized debate between those who think sanctions are bad and those who think sanctions are good. I want to understand the historical context of sanctions or targeted measures. And I would want to say that in my view, it's 20 years of these so-called targeted measures. They have not achieved the purpose for which they were put in place. They've become more token, in my view. They are certainly different from the mandatory UN sanctions that we've seen before in Rhodesia and in other countries. And secondly, they have not punished the so-called targeted individuals. On the contrary, these people remain very, very prosperous, if not more prosperous than they were in 2001 when the sanctions were introduced. And therefore, for me, the issue of the debate about sanctions must be based primarily on whether they are achieving their purpose, which is to improve, influence, or I don't want to say force, but this influence political and economic reforms. They have not achieved that. On the contrary, we have gone downwards in terms of the economy. In political terms, we've gone worse because we have a coup government in place. So nothing has improved. So there's need to change the paradigm and move. And that's why I welcome the envoy's reference to a structured dialogue. A structured dialogue, for me, structured dialogue, which is almost like just quoting us in our statements from the Transition Authority. It is time to sit down and look for a way forward through a combination of national, regional, and international cooperation towards a political settlement. Zimbabwe is in dire need of a political settlement. After that, all else follows. That is the bottom line. Mm.
Piers, heard Ibo there talk about how the special rapporteur is calling for a structured dialogue. Is that something you think can happen at this point?
Well, you know, I was watching the or listening to the ZANU-PF spokesman today, who was talking about this is an endorsement of the existing political actors' dialogue process, which is a controversial process that has been introduced by President Mnangagwa and does not have the support of the mainstream opposition, MDC Alliance. I do not think that what is being referred to is the POLAB process, and I do think it is kind of dialogue that Ibo Mandaza is referring to, one that also moves beyond the kind of, and this is something Special Rapporteur Doan has said, moves beyond and abandons the kind of rhetoric of sanctions as an advocacy tool, which is what we continue to see from some players here, to see what advantage. It seems very unlikely in the run-up to an election in the next 18 months or so that we are going to see a real commitment from certain actors to that kind of dialogue, unfortunately.
Obert, from your point of view, are there conditions in place right now in Zimbabwe whereby there could be a framework developed for some kind of national dialogue or constructive dialogue going forward?
Oh yes. Oh, yes. You know, the main challenge I think that some of our colleagues have had in Zimbabwe is this issue of saying if the dialogue is not like, driven or literally, conducted by foreign powers or foreign individuals, then it is not a legitimate dialogue. To say, no, we want SADC to initiate the dialogue, we want the African Union to initiate the dialogue. There have even been calls for the United Nations to initiate the dialogue. And some of us just say, okay, why? Because we are looking at Zimbabwe, with one of Africa's highest rates of literacy. We have got tremendous human capital within the country, Zimbabwean human capital, and also human capital in the diaspora. We have some of the most skilled people across whatever profession or professional divide you may want to think of. We have Zimbabweans who are capable of doing that. So I think the moment that people then say, for as long as the dialogue maybe is initiated inwardly and does not include some foreign interests, and we know who these foreign interests are. I mean, these are ours, in the opposition for more than 20 years of my life, and I know how the opposition is driven. I know the hand of the foreign hand in the opposition politics in Zimbabwe because I was there. I was there right in the mix. I was in the National Standing Committee of the MDC, so I know what I'm talking about. So dialogue is already happening. There's the Pollard process in Zimbabwe, and I believe that it is one of the most patriotic and one of the most actually all-inclusive dialogue platforms. So why are other people not interested in Pollard to say, no, we want a bilateral dialogue between President Mnangagwa and ourselves, which doesn't include all other players? It simply won't cut, and it won't happen. It's not going to happen. Why? Because politics includes everybody, the so-called big political players and the so-called small political players. And Pollard is right, the perfect fit for that kind of dialogue. So Pollard it is.
Ibo, you wrote a piece in which you said the vain expectations that the November 2017 coup would redeem Zimbabwe from the international isolation under the Zimbabwe is open for business mantra have all but gone up in smoke. Why is that?
So I'm very surprised to hear my brother Obert Gutu utter those words. I mean, I'm shocked that he thinks Pollard is a way forward for Zimbabwe. Absolutely shocked. You know, everyone knows that Pollard is a cul-de-sac. It's going nowhere. I mean, the majority of Zimbabweans know that. If he doesn't, I'm surprised. Secondly, I think that the only way forward is a kind of dialogue which begins. There are many interpretations of that. There's a whole dialogue industry in Zimbabwe, including the Pollard one, which is the most blatantly a failure. But I believe dialogue genuine dialogue must begin with the recognition or the restoration of constitutionalism in Zimbabwe. Return the rule of law and return of the military to the barracks. That is the bottom line for a dialogue that takes us forward. And Zimbabwe has always been an internationalized situation, right through from the 1961 constitutional talks to the Lancaster House agreement. We believe that we need to return to that kind of situation again, with the help of the region and with the help of the international community. I've stated in the article that you have cited that the international factors who have imposed targeted sanctions on Zimbabwe need to have a paradigm shift to give some kind of to engage with Zimbabweans across the divide, to engage, to scaffold genuine dialogue that begins, as I said earlier, with a structured fashion. I wonder when this lady referred to a structured dialogue. I thought she was almost quoting the document we did in 2016, long before the coup, when we saw the coup coming, that we reached a stage where we're not going anywhere. And to think that we're going somewhere with Pollard, I think that is delusional, to say the least. Thank you.
Piers, from your perspective, will the special rapporteur's work be able to enable a broader fact-based engagement on the issues that she's been investigating?
Well, it should be. I think this really is the next step. It's unfortunate that we're only going to see a final report in September next year. But I think there's a great deal of interest that this is an issue that requires attention. There is a real opportunity in front of us to have that fact-based discussion that goes beyond the posturing that we see continuing, even in the face of the statement that she has made, cherry-picking of the issues from that statement. The question, as I said earlier, is whether the key parties are prepared to come to the table on this front. It's not as if there aren't opportunities and spaces for this kind of dialogue, either internally or between the parties instituting sanctions and those at the receiving end. There is an opportunity to do this. Let's see really now how the actors respond to this call from the special rapporteur. But I do think she also has a responsibility to see how best she can facilitate that and to catalyze the discussion. Because what I see on the table at the moment from her is provocations, which are important provocations, but people will need to see what the evidence is that back up those provocations in order to enable and to catalyze that discussion.
Piers, let me just follow up with you real quick, and we only have about a moment left. What do you foresee happening when the special envoy presents her final report next year?
Well, there'll have to be clearly a scrutiny of what she puts on the table. And again, I hope that that's another injection, bearing in mind that we're likely still to have these measures in place, that provides another opportunity to drive this discussion forward. And it seems to me that external actors from the region, from the continent and so forth, could play an important role in enabling that conversation. But it requires something which we haven't had much of, really, and that's a level of honesty. And the move away from posturing and a more empirically rooted discussion, I think, is the way to go. But unfortunately, I think, as we see with the broader issues around dialogue, the key parties are not willing to go that way.
All right, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Obert Gutu, Piers Pigou, and Ibo Mandaza. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. We're at AJInsideStory. From me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.